This is the House Finance Committee. It's approximately 2:10 on Thursday afternoon, May the 8th. Members that we have present with us today at this time, Representatives Moses, Foster, myself, Terrio, Mulder, Martin, and Coring. First bill that we will take up, since Representative Davies is not right here right now, we will go to Senate Bill 189. We have a representative from sponsor's office here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sheila Peterson, staff to Senator Gary Wilkin. Unfortunately, Senator Wilkin is at the Majority Caucus right now, otherwise he would be here. Senator Wilkin was a member of the Senate Finance Subcommittee on Education, and as such, he heard an overview by the Alaska Post-Secondary Commission. He was struck by the number of loans that are serviced by the commission. This year, the demand for loans is going to be between $60 and $70 million, with the average age of 27 years old. Unfortunately, the current default rate is unacceptable. It's at 18%, and this really concerns Senator Wilkin. He met with Diane Behrens, the executive director of the Post-Secondary Commission, and asked her what could be done to try to bring this default rate into a more acceptable range. Senate Bill 189 is a product of that meeting. It provides the necessary financial tools to effectively and efficiently help reduce the rate of those loans in default. It is the goal of this legislation that it will ensure that the Post-Secondary Commission and the loans will be available for the next generation of Alaskans. Diane Behrens is here from the Post-Secondary Commission if anyone has any questions in detail about the legislation.
Thank you. Are there questions for this witness? If not, Diane, would you like to come forward? Or Sheila, if you want to stay there in case there are questions, that'd be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Rather than give you any extensive testimony on this bill, I'd like to simply say that the Commission has endorsed the elements of this bill. They primarily consist of additional collection tools for defaulted borrowers. There is a provision for a 0.5% increase in the interest rate on the loans, and there is a provision to allow some front-end credit assessment for applicants. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
So, Diane, what would that set the interest rate at then?
Well, it actually, Mr. Chairman, it would not change the interest rate for this coming year because those promissory notes have already been produced and we've awarded a number of applications already. So for the 98-99 academic year, it would probably be about 9%. We won't know at this time because the basis for the interest rate is the rate that we're paying on outstanding bonds. So we will be paying off some bonds between now and then. But I suspect it would be somewhere in the 8.9 to 9.1 range.
And could you just walk us through the collection?
Certainly.
Things that you're doing here. And I see that we've got a bunch of different fiscal notes here from the different agencies that would be involved in those collection activities. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. The first substantive change in the bill is in Section 5. Section 5 identifies the, it's page 3, Section 5 identifies the increase from an administrative add-on of 2.5 to 3%. The next substantive change is in Section 6, page 5. And there on line 26, you'll see that we will be authorized to do a credit assessment on borrowers to see if they have egregious chronic bad debt. In the event that an applicant is shown to have bad debt, Section 7 of the bill on page 6 allows for a creditworthy co-signer to allow them to still qualify for the loan. And in the next section, 8, on page 7, a new ability for the commission would be administrative wage garnishment. Currently, we can do wage garnishments, but we do have to go to the court, get a judgment, and execute on that. That is done by the collection agencies after someone is in default. And because of the cost and time invested in doing that, they tend to look at the size of the debt and make a decision about whether it's worth the expense of going after that. So the administrative wage garnishment, which is a tool that was given to child support enforcement and after which this is modeled, this tool would allow us to do it in a less expensive way. I would note that Alaska statutes do hold harmless a certain portion of an individual's paycheck. We are not asking for any exception from that law.
So all the applicable statutes dealing with assets that can be held as a debt is collected still stay in place, and all of those apply in an administrative?
With regards to what we're requesting, Mr. Chairman, I know that child support actually got a waiver of that. We're not asking for a waiver of that. Then on page 9 of the bill, same section, we're asking for an expansion of an existing tool that we have, and that's to leverage the renewal of licenses issued by the state for borrowers that are in default. A bill that was passed by the legislature the year before last allowed us to do that for licenses that are issued by the Division of Occupational Licensing. We're now asking for perhaps a more level playing field so that if a license is issued by Department of Labor, if it's issued by Department of Education, that we're able to go in and require that those renewal applicants also are in good standing on their student loan or at least are making payments on a regular basis. And those are the substantive changes in the bill.
Are there other questions for?
I didn't hear you mention anything about the occupational license issue. Maybe you did and I didn't hear you. But is there a provision in here that would give you the authority to withdraw someone's occupational license they might have due to default or non-payment or whatever?
Through the chair, Representative Coring, we currently have that authority through the Division of Occupational Licensing. We don't try to revoke during a period of being licensed, but those licenses are renewed on a 3-year basis. So about 6 months prior to a renewal cycle, we'll do a match of our defaulter database against those applicants that are coming for renewal within the next 6 months. And if they are in default, we do notify them that they have to be either in a payment arrangement or current on their debts in order to renew their license. We don't try to intervene in the initial licensing because, of course, they need to have an opportunity to practice that profession in order to make payments.
Mr. Chairman, as a continuation, please. So there's no modification to this legislation that deals with that issue, then?
Through the chair, Representative Coring, there is an expansion of it. This asks for a change so that we can have that same process in place with Department of Labor, which issues some licenses, Department of Education, which also issues teachers' licenses, if you will. And that's pretty much it.
And lastly, I just have difficulty with that one, frankly, as far as folks having the ability to be able to go after one's license and the ability to be able to support themselves and even ultimately pay off those loans. I know that by the time you get to the point of withdrawing their license, they're in a default status, you know, and chances are probably pretty good that they would never pay the loan. But it still seems to me that the prospect of them possibly paying would be there, but it might be decreased if you take away their ability to be able to make a living.
Actually, if I can just respond through the chair, Representative Coring, I did misspeak. This will allow a temporary licensure issue. Right now, they simply have to be in compliance with some payment arrangement in order to renew. In the 12-month period between December and between January and December of 96, we had 61 individuals who were identified as being in this category. 48 of those individuals either began making payments or made a lump sum payment. 13 of them did not renew. Several were out of state and therefore not practicing. Several were in state and not practicing. So in almost every case that I'm aware of, it has been effective, and the individuals have found a means to begin making payment in order to have that license renewed. So this actually adds a protection for them so that they'll get a six-month period of time in which to become compliant with a payment arrangement after that license is up. If within that six-month period of time they do not, however, they would not be able to get a permanent or the longer-term renewal of their license.
Did you indicate that was an identical provision to what was passed just a couple of years ago for CSED? In fact, I think it was Representative Davies. I had a bill or an amendment. The same kind of provision for temporary licensure for a six-month period of time?
Yes, Representative Terrio, we modeled our legislation after theirs.
Representative Martin?
Have you thought of getting ahead of the problem rather than always behind it? We used to have collateral guaranteed by the parents. Are we still against such things? Any collateral at all asked by the students?
Through the chair, Representative Martin, these still are unsecured notes. They have, in my experience with the program, always been unsecured notes. So the credit assessment and requirement for the creditworthy cosigner will be the first step in that direction. But the concern is that almost 40% of our borrowers are individuals from age 18 to 21, and the concern has been that for people whose parents either are unwilling or unable to put up collateral, they would be left without an opportunity to fund their education.
Mr. Chairman, if we had more requirement for being in the state similar to the permanent fund dividend check, which to me is worthless when we know the biggest percentage of it used to be when I was involved in this, a default were Alaskans themselves, long-time Alaskans. Is it new Alaskans coming in, or what's the bulk of your default rate? How do you categorize it?
Through the chair, Representative Martin, we have not done any recent analysis of who the people going into default within, say, the last year and a half have been. But about 60% of our borrowers, we have no research and analysis staff, so we have to take, I would be the person doing that, so it's a matter of just prioritizing that. And we have not looked at it within the last few months. We examine the default rates and we're working on it, but as far as whether they're in-state or out-of-state, we haven't thoroughly analyzed that. We do know that about 60% of our defaulters are in Alaska. One of the tools that we aggressively use is the permanent fund dividend garnishment. This last year, we identified about 9,000 defaulters in the PFD applicant pool and collected about $7.5 million on defaulted loans in that manner.
Are you still limited to 50% on that, or can you get 100%?
Through the chair, we receive all of the amount of the dividend up to whatever is owed. So unless they owe less than the dividend amount, we collect the entire amount.
Some organizations are limited to 50% because they said the person won't apply for them, but you're not. Good. Thank you. Oh, I do have one other question. It seems to me that we keep on adding the fees for services and for the default rates. Now you're asking for 3%, and it's always because the good people are being charged more and more for those who are defaulting and just could care less. And I just thought it would be a normal thing of any agency when you're losing money, you see where your weakness is. You don't need a specialist of a specialist research with 10,000 degrees. You know, these people are bums, these people are good. You know, this age group is doing good, the women are doing much better than the men.
Representative Martin, the tough part is there's no box on the application to check whether you're a bum or not.
No, but you can see that people are fitting in this kind of category. Right.
Well, you're not going to know until the end, and hopefully by doing these checks now, we are going to be able to identify those people that probably are at higher risk of defaulting and require either a signature or guarantor on the loan, and it's going to...
Well, we had it before. I don't know where they lost it at post-secondary. It was regular information when I sat there.
Through the chair, Representative Martin, I've been with the agency for approximately 15 years, and we've never had that provision, and it shows in our default rate.
And quick question on your, just looking through all the fiscal notes, and I see that most agencies had programmed in here some salary, either a quarter of a position or 50% of a position, some reprogramming for their computer system to match up with your default lists. Yours, though, I didn't see. Why does it bump up to 32.8 in fiscal year 99 and then come back down to the 15,000? It's the student loan operations?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, the reason for that is the first year that we'll probably do credit assessment, if we're successful this year, about half of the students will have already applied for and been granted awards. So the amount that we're actually doing the credit assessments on will be about 50% or less of the borrowing population. The next year, we'll do that credit assessment on everyone coming in, so we expect that cost to increase. After that point, we won't repeatedly credit check the continuing students. Once they're in the pipeline, we'll continue to fund them.
I see. Okay. Are there further questions for the witness?
Sure.
Representative Davies?
On the issue of the fiscal notes, presumably, if we do this, we're gonna have some positive impact on the repayment rate. And does that? I don't see that reflected in the.
Through the chair, Representative Davies, it should be in post-secondary's fiscal note. There's some attached analysis. And it's, we refer to it as loss avoidance. And you'll see on page 2 of the 3-page fiscal note that we've attached that we anticipate loss avoidance of perhaps up to $3 million a year as a result of that. So it clearly offsets the fiscal cost.
And actually, you wouldn't realize that loss for probably past where we check on the fiscal notes. So.
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay, are there further questions? Are there any amendments? Representative Foster?
Are you ready to move it out?
Yes, and I will note that I have looked over the fiscal notes and talked to my staff. I think some of the requested funding is questionable. If the bill does pass, the conference committee would take a further look at the. There probably would be some shaving of the fiscal notes at the conference committee. With that, Representative Foster.
Okay, I'll go ahead and move SB 189 out of the attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection to moving the bill with the individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes? If not, the bill will move. Next, Representative Davies, we held off Senate Bill 3. You indicated this morning that you might have an amendment. So we will take up Senate Bill 3 at this time.
Mr. Chair, we've been looking at that, and the amendment that we were trying to craft doesn't fit in under the title, so we will be offering them.
Are you ready for this?
Were there any further questions following this morning's discussion on the bill for the spokesman for the prime sponsor? If not,
I'd like to go ahead and move SB 3 out of this committee with individual recommendations and in the attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection to moving the bill with the accompanying fiscal notes? If not, the bill will move from committee.
It would be good because when I was a kid, we had to stop breaking into houses at 9 p.m. They'd have fire alarms go off.
Okay, the next bill that I would like to take up is House Bill 47, Telephone Victim Notification System.
Are you ready to move that?
Okay, why don't we then go to Senate Bill 34. Somebody here from Senator Torgerson's office, or Representative Davies, were you going to?
Yes, I certainly can, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 34 is... provides for a lease purchase arrangement between the state and either the bond council or the city of Soldotna. It's an option in the language, whichever is approved either by the legislature or the department to replace the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities maintenance facility in the city of Soldotna. We've been trying to get this facility relocated for over 20 years. Members, citizens of Soldotna and surrounding area. And in the last five to 8 years, there's been considerable attention drawn to the facility due to the increase in sport fishing activity and development around the on the banks of the Kenai River, which run through Soldotna. This parcel of land, it's about a 7-acre parcel in downtown Soldotna, located on the river, and it's been located there since, I believe, the early 50s, and it's a real eyesore, and it's an environmental hazard. Over years of stockpiling fuel and storing equipment and doing the mechanic and maintenance and repair on vehicles for several years, and storage of the calcium chloride sand piles on the property. As anyone who travels down the Kenai River can see, when they come to this site, it's just a barren, a brown spot on the bank. And so we've been working for years to try and get this facility relocated. There's been cooperation with the state, the city of Soldotna, and the Kenai Peninsula Borough. We've identified a new site for the facility and have attempted to find funding the last 4 or 5 years. And after discussions last year with the administration, with the city and the borough, and legislators involved and concerned about the facility, we've come to the conclusion that this is the mechanism of choice at this time, and would certainly appreciate everyone's concern to get this facility relocated and clean up the site, and the old facility tore down, sold, relocated, whatever might happen to it.
On your or on the sponsor statement, it says the Kenai Peninsula Borough owes the state the acreage. Why is it that
Mr. Chairman, in the early 60s, I believe it was, the state conveyed to the borough a parcel of land, a parcel of state land, conveyed it to the borough, and the borough took ownership of that land. And part of that agreement back then was that then the borough owed the state some land. So the state gave the borough some land, and in return the agreement was that the borough would then owe the state some land. And the city of Soldotna approached the borough and said, hey, you owe the state some land, and we're all interested in relocating the DOT facility, and we've gotten together with the state, and we think that together we have identified a parcel of borough land that is appropriate, appropriate location for the new facility. And the borough said, yes, we'd gladly want to help and assist you in the endeavors of relocating the facility. And so the borough is waiting for this transaction to convey the land to the state.
Okay. Representative Davies.
The new site that the borough's going to transfer will basically just be conveyed at no cost to the state. Is that?
That's correct.
And that site has no cleanup issues on it. It's not, there's no contamination.
No, it's a virgin piece of ground located about 2 miles south of Soldotna. It's there's some. It's within the proximity of the solid waste facility in Soldotna. I believe there has been. I'm not certain. I believe there has been some test holes and corings done to satisfy the environmental integrity of the parcel.
And then the site that you're vacating, there are some cleanup issues there. Does the amount of money that's involved here conflict cleaning that up, or where will the money come to clean?
No, they've been, Mr. Chairman, Representative Davies, they've been working on that. I believe there was a $150,000 contract last summer. I visited the site during the during the operations. They're not, I don't believe they're completed yet. There's additional monies that has been appropriated in past sessions, budget cycles. I believe there's close to $600,000 left to continue cleanup operations, and then I believe there's some additional dollars in the capital budget this year to provide what is expected to be the completed amount of money needed to complete the environmental cleanup. There has been an assessment done on the property.
And the amount that's in this year's budget, assuming that goes all through the process, will be, you think, substantially complete the cleanup?
It's anticipated. That's anticipated. There are in a 7.5-acre parcel, and with the length of time the facility has been there, I think there's been enough. I certainly hope there's been enough testing done to determine the extent of the contamination, so that the dollars that they have lined up would take care of it.
And then what did you indicate? I didn't quite follow. What's the plan then for that site once it's cleaned up? Would the state dispose of it, or?
I believe the city of Soldotna has an adjoining city park. Soldotna Creek Park adjoins this parcel. There's been discussions extending the park and utilizing it as public property. It will be utilized as public property, I think, as far as a hard and fast plan as to what the existing site will be utilized for is not in ink. There's been discussion about the Kenai River Center, which is a one-stop shopping for permitting along the river, which is something that everybody's been working on for a number of years. Matter of fact, there is a Kenai River Center now, but it's in a lease building, I believe. And so I believe there are plans to construct what's called the Kenai River Center for people wanting to get permits along the river. And also, I think there's been discussion also of relocating the Kenai Visitors and Information Center on the site also.
And if there are no further questions for Representative Davis, I see we have Sam Keto signed up representing DOT. And also we have Forrest Brown from Department of Revenue if there are questions on the debt servicing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sam Keto, Special Assistant to Commissioner Perkins with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. We're basically here to offer our support for this legislation. We're very interested in removing our facility from the riverside and onto the new site. I'd be willing to answer any questions. This is a situation that we've actually been working on with the delegation from the Soldotna area for several years now, and are glad to see that we're getting relatively close to a solution.
Sam, is this something that the administration has considered for capital, straight to capital appropriation? Or has it been submitted and just not made the final cut?
Mr. Chairman, there was some interest in putting a capital appropriation in about 3 years ago that did not get all the way through the capital budget process. Based on that and other discussions that we've had with the City of Soldotna, the City of Soldotna's interest in getting the facility moved and their interest in possibly offering up bonds for the facility got the department and the state to start looking at bonding options. So this is pretty much where we ended up.
And the ownership of the existing parcel, or first of all, the existing structure, is there money for the demolition or removal?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there is money for demolition of the existing structure as well as construction of the proposed structure. And then there's separate appropriations that we hope will be adequate to deal with the environmental cleanup.
And then who ultimately owns the piece of property then?
Mr. Chairman, the existing piece of property where the maintenance station stands right now is state property and will be transferred to the City of Soldotna.
Will that be part of their municipal selection?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have an answer to that.
Representative Davis, do you know, is there still...
I don't believe there are any additional municipal selections that the city has. I'm not certain of that, but I'm not aware of any additional selections. And Mr. Chairman, if I might, the cost of the new facility is projected at $4.5 million. The 4.9, the additional $400,000 is included for demolition and relocation or relocation of the existing structures.
Are there further questions? Representative Davies?
Is it the borough then that's giving us the land for the new site?
Whatever, Mr. Chairman, whatever ownership needs to be transferred, the borough, if the state does the lease, it would be conveyed to the state. There's also the option of the city assigning a lease purchase agreement with the state. So if the city bonds, the city will need to own the property. So whichever, there's the flexibility because title hasn't been transferred yet to the parcel by the borough, and the bonding arrangements haven't been established, which whether the state would bond or they would lease purchase under a city bond.
Sorry, Mr. How many acres is the new site and how many acres is the old site?
Mr. Chairman, the new site is 15 acres, I believe.
And the old site is?
The existing site on the river that is 7.5 acres, I believe.
I guess what confuses me here is it sounds like what we're doing is we're satisfying a borough debt of land by giving it, but then we're going to just give the old site to the city of Soldotna. So I'm a little confused about the fiduciary responsibility here of the state.
Well, and Representative Davis, the ownership of that, the old piece of property, the transfer of that is not mandated here. I think there's going to have to be further action to make that transfer, which I think warrants some further evaluation by the legislature.
At a later date, right?
At a later date. If it's still contaminated, you can have it.
Oh,
if it's contaminated.
Yeah.
Please.
Are there further questions for Representative Davis? If not, Representative Mulder?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's not very often in this legislature we found a bill that both commercial and sport fishermen like. So this is one. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would propose that we move CS for SB 34 from committee with individual recommendations in the coming fiscal note.
Are there objections to moving the bill with individual recommendations? And there are two fiscal notes. One has the debt service. Seeing no objections, the bill will move from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I object because I wanted to move it. Mr. Chairman, I went through that through Soldotna and with the transportation committee about 5 years ago and looked at that, and
right.
It was quite a problem at that time.
Mm-hmm. Would it be better in Nome, though?
I was really worried about our environment.
We love to talk.
I know that there are a couple of DOT facilities on the Hall Road that are going to need work sometime, too, so I'll put a little note away and remember this when we come to deal with those. Okay, next we'll go now back to House Bill 47. Representative Kemplin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 47 is a piece of legislation that authorizes the Department of Corrections to provide an automated victim notification and prisoner information system. And I believe you have the backup for that, and I'm here to, as are other individuals, to answer any questions you may have about the piece of legislation.
Okay. On the fiscal note, is the 150 a real hard and fast number? Because I see that as a problem for the bill. At this time, we're bumping up against the cap of what we have budgeted for in the fiscal notes this year. And I'm just wondering if there's any kind of middle ground or phase-in or something of that nature that would increase the chances of the bill being funded.
Well, the a number of the costs associated are one-time cost. The fiscal note in terms of the fiscal year 98, you may be able to move some of the general fund down to program receipts. It would be anticipated that the system would be up and running within the fiscal year 98, and I'm not sure exactly how much money would be that the system would acquire from the use, but there is a possibility that the system could be up and running for 6 to 8 months with the potential for some program receipts.
What are the source of the program receipts in the out years?
Those are incurred by the individuals calling into the system, and they are assessed a charge each time they call into the system.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Kemplin? I think we probably all have been visited by the young lady from Anchorage a couple weeks back.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're probably all pretty aware of what's being proposed here. As I indicated, I think that the fiscal note is going to be somewhat problematic. It may be beneficial, and this would be an adjustment that the conference committee could make to perhaps make somewhat of a shift down to program receipts. If program receipts then do end up coming in, budget not, it could make a further adjustment if that was needed to help with the project. Representative Mulder.
As much as I hate doing this, one of the thoughts in relation to addressing the problems of the conference committee is there are a variety of different fund potential sources. As the biggest nut to crack here is the $150,000 upfront. And then on the hope it's driven by program receipts. And to allow the committee maximum flexibility, one of the things we might consider as a committee is to give them basically the authorization to establish this without necessarily a fund source driven here, and then work to try and find a fund source through the next 48 hours in the budgetary process in conference committee or capital budget or reappropriations or somewhere.
Yeah. Well, Representative Mulder, I think that before we take final action on the fiscal notes, we hopefully will know a little bit more of whether there is room for the one-time cost in the reappropriations or maybe the final bit of room in what was budgeted for supplementals even. We could take action on the bill with this fiscal note, and that still leaves full latitude to the conference committee. And of course, we will be discussing the fiscal year 98 capital budget tomorrow also. Representative Davies.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's probably some room to reflect the fact that it's going to take some time. There's some contracts that need to be put out on the street, and I think that in consultation with Representative Kemplin, I think that there is some possibility to reduce the initial one time somewhat in reflection of that time period that's going to be required to get contracts on the street. And then I think once the system is up and running, even in FY98, the end of that year, there should be some opportunity to be collecting some, the way the system's intended to operate, to collect some revenues there. So I would suggest there's an opportunity for two things. One, to reduce the amount a little bit, just in reflection of it's not going to be running the whole time. And secondly, to shift some to program receipts in reflection of the fact that you should be recouping in the last quarter, perhaps, some revenues in the mechanisms intended in the out years. So I think that both, those two kinds of adjustments could be made. And I don't know, perhaps it would be better to wait, though, to the conference committee to do those, but I think that those are available.
Well, Representative Kemplin or Representative Davies, if you have numbers to suggest at this point, we could go ahead and make that shift.
I would defer to Representative Kemplin if he has the numbers. We've discussed it kind of conceptually a little bit along those lines, but I don't have, if I were to offer it, it would just be fairly round numbers and not based in a lot of forethought.
Representative Kemplin, do you have some suggestions for shifts in the fiscal note? Or
well, I'd probably have to defer to the department. They're the ones who will be administering and implementing this initiative, and to get a sense from them as to what are they going to be able to do and when.
Obviously,
wouldn't want to speak for them.
Okay. I see the only other person I have signed up here is Jane Andreen. Jane, did you want to testify? Okay, if you would come up and Representative Kemplin, if you go ahead and stay there. And was there anybody here from the... Oh, okay. Well, let's take Jane first then.
...violence and sexual assault. And I'm here to express the council's support of House Bill 47. Mary Frances Byron was a young woman living in Kentucky. She had ended a relationship with her boyfriend, and after she ended that relationship, he began stalking her. In November of 1993, that boyfriend, Donovan Harris, held her at gunpoint for 3 hours, raping her throughout that time period. He was arrested on November 19th and charged with kidnapping and rape. His gun was confiscated. Over the next 3 weeks, Mary Frances Byron, fearing for her life, repeatedly called the authorities to find out when he was going to be released. She was told every time she called that he was still in custody. On December 1st, however, Harris's sister posted the $26,000 bond, and 5 days later, Still believing that her attacker was in jail, Ms. Byron left her job, went out to her car, got into it, and started it to warm it up. While she was sitting in her car, Mr. Harris, who'd obtained another gun, shot at her from the side and behind. The first shot was fatal, but he shot her 6 more times before he finished. He was arrested immediately. It needs to be noted also that that day, December 6th, was Mary Frances Byron's 21st birthday. Her parents were enraged. Mary Frances had done everything that she could to try to protect herself, and had she known that he was released, she would have taken additional steps to protect herself. However, they were able to turn their rage and their grief into advocating for a countywide automated victim notification system, which was implemented approximately 1 month after her death. That system was so successful that shortly thereafter it was adopted statewide throughout Kentucky. Since that time, nationwide, a number of states have been looking at how they can improve their notification of victims. As you folks know, Alaskans passed the Victim Rights Amendment in 1994. Victims now have the constitutional right to be notified of the status of their offenders as well as to be able to participate in the process. That, combined with the new domestic violence law as well as House Bill 9, which just passed this session, increases the responsibilities of the Department of Corrections to maintain and notify victims of the status of their offenders. This system will do 3 things, 2 of which are especially important for victims. One is once the change of status is entered into the computer, the victim will be automatically notified by telephone of that status change. Second, and I think even more importantly, is victims will be given a PIN number and a telephone number that they'll be able to call at any time to find out the status of their offender. One of the problems that we're aware of that Corrections has is victims relocate or change their phone numbers and do not notify Corrections of those changes, so Corrections has a difficult time contacting them. Both of these items will greatly increase the victim's ability to protect themselves. One of the concerns that I have is people talk about funding, and I realize it's the Finance Committee. You need to look at your financial responsibilities. But is that what this bill can do and what the system will accomplish is too important to put aside for concerns about money. California was one of the states that was looking at doing something like this but was concerned about how they were going to pay for it. One of the folks that works with the Vine system testified a few weeks ago in House State Affairs that they had just contacted his company a few days before that after an offender was released and murdered his victim because she had not been notified. I don't think that we can continue to sit back and wait for this type of tragedy to occur when we have the potential for something like this to increase the safety of victims. That's it.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Andreen? If not, we'll have Bob Cole with the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Bob Cole. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Corrections. Happy to be here.
You don't have to lie.
With respect to the this fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, was built with the assumption that we would use general funds to crank this system up and pay 100% of the monthly charges for its first year of operation. And it also cut the cost down from original estimate of $250,000 to $150,000 by only installing vines in the beginning at the 13 correctional institutions, 13 probation and parole offices, and the CRCs and the community jails, and not the prosecutor's offices or local police departments and so forth. As the sponsor said a few minutes ago, the way this thing should work once it's up and running is that there be about $1.25 per call charge made to people making general calls for information about inmates, and we estimate that system-wide we get about 600 of those phone calls a day. If you do the math real quickly, you realize that's a potential of $250,000 more or less for program revenue in the future. Didn't think that we could get that much by any means the first year. Don't really know what the call volume will be once a charge is installed, and built these numbers off some conversations with the vendors and sponsors and other folks. So thinking about the conversation that you had a few minutes ago, which is, could you whittle the fiscal note down reasonably and still get the system installed the first year? And thinking about the fact by the time you put it out to bid and go through the contracting process, which we will have to do in any event, and then have some time for system implementation, figure a good portion of the year is gone. It may well be possible to cut down on the cost for the monthly fees, both for the operational fees, primarily for the operational fees to Vines, and also to some extent for the operational fees for port fees for that we have to pay to the Department of Administration Division of Information Services to keep the WAN ports open for this system. So I think I discussed this with the sponsor a bit this morning. I do think that the fiscal note could be whittled down a bit, and I just gave the gentleman some numbers that I think could get it down close to $100,000.
Right, down on the fund source then would go to 104.7?
If that's general fund program receipts?
It's just listed here.
General fund the first year.
Actually,
general fund the first year, and in the, do you not have the fiscal note?
I think I do. I'm sorry, I don't have it. I have the detail in my hand rather than the fiscal note itself. The idea here would be is one-time startup costs would be general funds, and then the bulk of the operating cost in the out years would be general fund program receipts paid for by these telephone calls.
Right. But up above then in the expenditure detail, where would the shift be up there?
It would all still be in contractual, sir, because the way this thing works is the vendor installs this system and then operates it. And all it really does is reach into our database and extract the change in status data on offenders, back it out into this automated notification system, and then the telephone calls and reports are automatically generated from Vines to the victims.
Okay. So I think that's a difference of $45,400.
The first year.
So we would just take that out of the contractual up above?
Yes, sir. Okay. I'm not recommending that, mind you. I'm just saying that's a possibility.
Representative Davis, did you have a question?
So when you make it 44.1, that makes the math easy.
We can do that. So contractual up above would just be 100. And we would just take the 44.1 out of the 50 down below. Representative Davis?
Chair, and then I would suggest that we add about 20,000 or so in program receipts down with the anticipation that in the fourth quarter when the system's up and running that they should start collecting a little bit.
Okay. Then if the members would just put a fund source of 20,000 down in the GF program receipts. Okay, are there any other?
Mr. Chairman,
questions?
One other thing I would like to say. If the system works the way everyone hopes that it will, and I hope it does, then next year, if in fact it generates a multiple of about 2.5 times the amount of general fund program receipt revenue required to continue this first part of the application, the department would probably want to come back next year through sponsors and others and suggest that if in fact we realize the kind of program receipts we think will be there, to go ahead and expand this then to the prosecutor's office and the police departments and public safety. It'd be self-generated financing for it. So
you'll be back to us for designated program receipt.
Yes, sir. Are
there further questions for the department spokesman? Further questions for the prime sponsor on the bill? Senator Foster.
You ready to move? Okay, I'll go ahead and move HB 47 out of committee with the amended fiscal notes, that's not, with the end of a draw recommendation.
Is there any objection to moving the bill from committee? And the bill will move with individual recommendations and the modified fiscal note. Okay, that brings us down to Senate Bill 151. What I would like to do today is just have Representative Mulder sort of walk us through the modified version of the bill. We'll also take whatever public testimony is here. I don't intend to move the bill from committee today, but I do want to hear some of the discussion on the modified form of the bill.
We could take a two-minute at ease, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Yeah, we'll take a brief
good
at ease.
Good idea.
John?
Gee.
If the committee will come back to order, we'll continue on here with Senate Bill 51. As I indicated, I do not intend to move the bill from committee. I would like Mr. Chance to go through the new proposed CS so we can take a look at that. And we have a number of people signed up to testify today. I'd like to get their verbal comments so that further work can be done on the bill if needed. With that,
Mr. Chairman?
I'm not certain. I don't have, I know there is a sectional that is done, but I don't believe it's in my bill packet, and I'm not sure if it's in other members' bill packets.
I've got it here.
Just want to make sure other people do have it.
Okay, I'll have this duplicated and passed out.
Is this one with the bullets on it?
Yes. Yeah, they do have it.
Oh, is it in the members' package?
Yes.
Yeah, the front of it, it's got the bullets on it.
Oh, it is in there. I'll take it back, Mr. Chairman. It's underneath the fiscal note.
Okay.
Section? I don't think I have a section.
Underneath the fiscal note?
Yeah. Hmm.
Mr. Chance, do you want to go through and give the highlights, just highlight sections of the bill?
I'll be happy to. For the record, I'm Art Chance. I assisted in drafting now the, I think this is version P of this piece of legislation on behalf of the House and Senate Finance Committees. Even in this considerably shortened version, it's still a long and fairly complex bill, so a brief summary of it is a little bit time-consuming. I'm not going to go through every section. I'm going to go through the ones that have some significant difference in them. If you look at the bill, version P is the proper draft for the committee substitute. Section 2 provides that the parties may not negotiate terms that are contrary to a statute, except if those terms are specifically made subject to bargaining. The duty to bargain under para was and will remain wages, hours, terms and conditions of employment, and the employer's personnel policies affecting terms and conditions of employment. That is not changed from the original version.
Can you just give a couple of explanations now of things then that would be moved out of the bargaining?
Excuse me, sir?
Could you just give a couple of examples of things then that would no longer be subject to the collective bargaining?
Certainly, sir. As a general matter, issues of public policy, as opposed to wages, hours, and conditions of employment, are not mandatorily bargainable. PARA has always made those four things, wages, hours, terms and conditions, and employer personnel policies affecting terms and conditions, a mandatory subject of bargaining. A mandatory subject of bargaining is one which the employer must consider the union's proposal. The union must consider the employer's proposal. Either party may persist the impasse. Those who have the right to strike could strike over a mandatory subject of bargaining. There are many things that parties can talk about and often do talk about, but can't be compelled to talk about. So what this does is the decision to institute a drug testing policy, for example, is a question of public policy. That is not bargainable. It's arguably not bargainable now. It's certainly not bargainable to this change. However, the effect of that drug policy is bargainable. How it impacts the wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment is bargainable, but the public policy decision to have a drug testing policy is not a bargainable subject. That's probably a fairly dramatic example, but it makes the distinction between questions of public policy and questions of wages, hours, and terms and conditions. Section 3 is something equivalent to a management's rights clause, and it's basically an instruction to an arbitrator or a court to narrowly construe a limitation on the employer's rights from that. Section 4 incorporates Alaska Labor Relations Agency regulations and decisions regarding composition of bargaining units and adds definitions of supervisory, confidential, and law enforcement employees based on our decisions. Bargaining units and political subdivisions, which were established by the former State Labor Relations Agency or the Alaska Labor Relations Agency prior to the effective date of the legislation, are exempted from the changes under Section 32 of the bill. It requires that peace officers, including correctional officers, must be in separate bargaining units from employees who are not peace officers. This reflects the guards provision in the federal law that is not based on ALRA decisions. Okay. Although the ALRA has decided that... Sir?
You want to just go through this whole thing, or you want to take questions section by section?
Well, if there's a brief question, I'd rather not get into a full debate because I do want to just at least go through the different sections. But if you have a quick question...
Well, I'd just like to know what the public policy rationale for requiring that police officers and correctional officers be in separate bargaining units.
Frankly, through the chair, Representative Davis, frankly, most of the impetus behind that came from union claims in labor relations agency hearings. There was a considerable move to rearrange the composition of the law enforcement bargaining units for the state over the last, say, 3 years. There were several decertification petitions for various and sundry units. One group of employees asking to have the current representative decertified. The argument they made, and at least for those of us who were involved in this, it was a fairly compelling argument, is the fact that these people, because of their law enforcement duties, are required to confront, sometimes arrest or incarcerate, other state employees, other members of their own union. And that has been the law, that people who had certain kinds of security responsibilities in the private sector have been exempt since at least 1947. Now, they've been not exempt, but in the separate bargaining unit as a matter of law since at least 47. And it was a fairly compelling argument that the duties are so different and the responsibilities are so different that the conflicts are inevitable. Section 5, Section 6 both reflect changes in ALRA regulations from the original statute over time. The original statute left out any opportunity for an employer to contest the majority, although ALRA has allowed that under regulation. We've placed that in statute. Section 6 requires ALRA to investigate the propriety of a mutually recognized bargaining unit if an employee petitions. There's been a certain amount of misrepresentation about that. The very act of an employee petitioning does nothing but invoke an investigation if the Labor Relations Agency finds that there is probable cause to believe the unit isn't appropriate, and there's a hearing, and if they find that it isn't appropriate, then there would be an election. Section 8 makes it an unfair labor practice for a public employer to contribute financial or other support to a union. That's taken essentially from federal law. It also allows a public employer to confer with its employees over work-related matters without incurring unfair labor practice charges. This is predicated on a National Labor Relations Board decision and ensuing court case called Electromation, which did find things like quality circles or work groups to be an unfair labor practice. That section also eliminates the current law's authorization of compulsory union membership while retaining the authorization for compulsory fees for collective bargaining. This is based on a long line of Supreme Court cases, including and then a federal district court case just held the same thing here in the state of Alaska involving one of the state bargaining units. It prohibits the...
Davies.
But there's some restrictions on the amount of that fee and the use of the fee.
Excuse me,
I didn't hear your question.
The service fee, I guess it's called in here, there's a new restriction placed on how that can be used?
Through the chair, sir. New to the law, I don't believe there's anything new to the line of court cases. The courts, and I can't give you a legal opinion, I'll give you a practitioner's knowledge because I've had to deal with a lot of union security agreements. The court says that a public employee cannot be compelled to support the social, fraternal, or political activities of a union. So to the extent that mandatory dues money might go to one of those activities, that cannot be compelled of a public employee. A public employee can, as a matter of public policy and as a matter of law, be compelled to pay for the actual service of collective bargaining, negotiating an agreement, administering an agreement, adjusting grievances. The Ninth Circuit has said that certain kinds of lobbying activities that go directly to getting a contract approved or to the wages and conditions are chargeable to a fee payer. But general social, fraternal, and political activities cannot be charged to a person who objects.
Excellent, Davis.
The use of those fees to help establish laws that maintain or enhance collective bargaining would not be appropriate?
I think that's a fact-based matter. Sir, I mean, at least the things I've read, and I'm not an attorney, so I can't rattle off the cites, but the Ninth Circuit has considered this, and if it relates directly to employee conditions, it is chargeable if to a fee payer. But general political activity is not chargeable to a fee payer as if it uses compulsory dues money. You can volunteer under this law. If you volunteer to pay for that, that's fine, but you can't be compelled to. Section 9, well, there's one other matter in 8, and there are provisions which are modeled on federal law which help to prevent the involvement of a private employer in a public employment labor dispute. Section 9 provides the statements.
Just real quickly, back on Section 8.
Yes, sir.
Would that be real analogous to the system under which NEA operates, as far as accounting for the different activities that the union provides and those that are the mandatory fees and those that are not?
Yes, it practically requires an accounting. There must be an accounting, and those which are mandatory go into this stack of charges, which can go to a mandatory service fee. Those which are not on chargeable subjects are calculated separately. And then a voluntary member would, of course, pay the full membership, but a person subject to a compulsory arrangement only pays for those costs which are chargeable to collective bargaining as opposed to other activities.
And the court cases behind that would all be the same? I mean, there's nothing particular about that?
There's nothing particular. My own understanding, and perhaps somebody from Department of Law could give you a much more definitive answer on this. My own understanding is there is as to what costs are chargeable in the realm of political activity, because that is an integral part of public employment. I think there's you would find some variance in the circuits, and I did do some research on the Ninth Circuit at one time back when I was working in the executive branch, and they were actually, to my mind, fairly liberal about the chargeability if it related to employment. If it related to other things, if a union lobbyist decided that they had some reason to come testify on the tobacco tax, for example, that would not be chargeable to a fee payer. Or at least I would not see how that would be chargeable to a fee payer. But certainly, my own belief is, at least under the rules as I understand them, certainly the activities of some of the people who are here today would be chargeable to a fee payer because this goes directly to bargaining rights. Section 9 provides that statements by legislators, judges, and certain municipal officials are not unfair labor practices unless they are specifically responsible for collective bargaining. Section 12 narrows the scope of employees prohibited from striking and thus subject to interest arbitration. Those employees who cannot strike upon impasse, the dispute goes to arbitration for the purpose, essentially, of writing a new contract. The old definition had been expanded considerably by both the Labor Relations Agency and the courts, and this says that it is exclusively these kinds of people. Section 13 narrows the scope of employees who can be enjoined from striking. That's a so-called Class 2 employee. It adds a class of residential care employees to reflect changes in Pioneer Home mission. Heretofore, they had always been considered Class 1 because the Pioneer Home was considered a hospital. As they've moved to assisted living, there's been questions as to whether or not that Class 1 definition would survive scrutiny. So the medical personnel of a Pioneer Home would remain Class 1, but the residential care would be Class 2. There would have to be a showing of harm, and then they could be enjoined back to work, whether a strike. Section 14 reflects a recent court case that said ferry system employees are Class 3 employees. There's been some debate over that over the years as to whether they were 2 or 3. Also provides that employees may only lawfully strike after impasse and bargain. Section 15 provides a reliable means of selecting arbitrators for interest arbitration and requires that they have Alaska Pacific Northwest experience. The old para just said that it would be selected in accord with 943030. It didn't tell you how you did it or what you did. This sets out a mechanism by which the parties get a list, choose from the list, and still provides that if they can't agree on how to which one to select, you could still go to court and have a court select the arbitrator. Section 16 prohibits agreements longer than 3 years and also prohibits automatic renewal clauses. It provides that employees may resort to binding grievance arbitration only under the terms of an agreement. It prohibits a labor organization that has failed to file the required financial reports from enforcing an agreement before the Labor Relations Agency. And it requires that ALRA, rather than the Commissioner of Administration, will promulgate regulations governing residency-based pay differentials. Section 19 establishes arbitrator selection criteria for binding grievance arbitration and requires Alaska or Pacific Northwest experiences, basically modeled on the same system that most but not all employers and unions anyway use, where you get a list from the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, come up with an agreed-upon list of 5, 7, 9, 11 arbitrators and strike names. Section 20 through 20...
In the language here, it says at least 7.
Yes.
Is there a standard number?
It varies. I've seen all kinds of contracts. It's always an odd number, and it's usually somewhere between 7 and 12. A lot of people used to use 5, but arbitrators have gotten so busy, or at least arbitrators that people will actually use, have gotten so busy that you need a larger list in order to be able to schedule an arbitration in any timely manner to get these things off. So at least 7. You have a good chance of scheduling timely. Sections 20 through 22 increase legislative oversight authority over collective bargaining by defining monetary terms to include extensions, modifications, and interest arbitrators award. There's been some controversy about the interest arbitrator awards. The courts have held that an interest arbitration award is the same as a voluntary agreement in terms of legislative oversight, so we just incorporated it into the statute. It specifically empowers the legislative body of a political subdivision to review and approve the monetary terms of an agreement. That comes out of a case out of Fairbanks. Provides that no monetary term is effective or enforceable until approved by the legislature or the legislative body. That also is based on the court's holdings in this state. It requires the parties to resume negotiations in the event of a legislative disapproval. They may not negotiate long. They may immediately establish that they are at impasse because neither party has a place to go, but they must at least get back together and bargain in good faith after a disapproval.
Question.
I just want to underscore that. So if there's a disapproval and they under whatever these terms are, they get back and they establish impasse, then there's for those that are eligible the right to strike at that point.
Right, yeah. You've got to go back and establish whether or not you have room to move or you are at impasse if there is a disapproval.
And prior to that, what would happen prior to this?
At least from the state's perspective, the belief always was that you had to come back, that a disapproval was not a part of the bargaining process and that you had to arrive at an impasse if there was a disapproval, and we'd had some experience with it.
Endless loop going back to the legislature.
Yeah, but in the last round of contract approvals, there were some pretty hearty threats to take a walk as soon as the legislature voted, and they were fairly credible. And one, although I believe it to have been an illegal strike, one strike did occur immediately upon a disapproval. This just makes it clear. And again, you might walk in and say, well, I don't have any money, and the union can say, we're not going to get an agreement unless you do, and that's pretty clear evidence of being at impasse. So.
Is there any time limit on that?
No, and there never has been, sir. I mean, the time limit is established by what it takes to establish good faith. You know, I mean, and good faith is usually in the eye of the trier of fact, is whether or not they believe that if one party proves that the other came in predisposed to a particular action and would not even consider any proposal they made, then the other party can charge unfair refusal to bargain. There's no specific timeline, but there must be good faith.
But, I mean, in terms of the ability it says here that to resume negotiations, is there some time frame on that? I mean, can that be Is it possible to drag that out so that you never get a chance to arrive at impasse?
I suppose it is possible to drag that out, but if the law already requires, and this bill does not change, that the parties meet at reasonable times and bargain in good faith. So if one party were dancing away from the other party, you go to the Labor Relations Agency with the unfair labor practice complaint and get them compelled back to the table. And that is in fact what happened the last time when there was a legislative rejection. One of the parties said, we aren't going to talk to you anymore, and walked away from the table. And we went to the Labor Relations Agency and they were compelled back. It requires the Commissioner of Administration to report all state agreements, settlements, and arbitrators' awards costing over $10,000 to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee for review. That is not an approval authority. It is review only. It requires the Commissioner of Administration to report all agreements, settlements, and arbitrators' awards that substantively modify the awarded terms to the legislature for approval. And it empowers the legislative bodies of political subdivisions to promulgate approval procedures. Section 23, there's a draft.
I'm sorry, just a second. The review, the mandatory reporting, what section was that again?
That is in, I believe that's in 22, sir.
I see, yeah, okay.
Section 23 is a drafting error. It prohibits irrevocable dues checkoffs for periods longer than 1 year and provides explicitly that checkoff authorizations must be voluntary. The requirement that they be renewed annually has been removed from the committee substitute. So once a person enters the check, if a voluntary member executes an authorization, it is good until that voluntary member revokes it. A compulsory fee payer's authorization cannot start before the effective date of the contract nor end after the effective date of the contract. Of course, if they wanted to continue paying, they could do it voluntarily. But they cannot be compelled to pay except during the term of the contract. Section 24. They cannot.
If you reach the end of a contract and you haven't established a new one, the mandatory fees stop during that interim.
Yes, the checkoff expires with the contract.
Even if you're effectively under terms in which you operate. Some contracts work in the way that if you can't reach a new one, you continue to operate under the old one. And
if there were an extension, that extension would presumably could include the union security clause. I can't imagine a union agreeing to an extension that didn't include the union security clause. If there is not an extension, you must, as a matter of law, an ALRA decision, you must maintain status quo on mandatory conditions until impasse or until a new agreement. You can't unilaterally change a mandatory subject to bargaining until impasse. But my understanding is, and the Labor Relations Agency has considered this a little bit, that once the contract expires, the union security clause is not a surviving condition.
Seems a little strange to me that the mandatory requirement is there to pay for collective bargaining services, and this is precisely the time when there's the most effort going on at collective bargaining.
The only response that I could offer to that is that perhaps a way to have that not cause problems for a labor organization is to negotiate a new contract before the prior one expires.
But it gives a pretty big incentive for an employer to just delay things.
The ability to stop that employer from delaying is in the unfair labor practice charge, and they can be, and bargaining charges can be decided very quickly.
Could you repeat that?
The ability to stop the delaying tactic, if there is a delaying tactic, was available and remains available under a refusal to bargain charge to the Labor Relations Agency, and any charge which occurs in the course of bargaining is considered a priority charge by the agency, and my experience was, certainly with the state, that they will hear those quite quickly, at least quickly by the agency standards.
Mr. Chair, just, I don't want to get into debating it, but just an observation is that there are negotiations that have gone on for many years and haven't been apparently in violation of any unfair labor practice, just that the issue has dragged on. During that whole period of time, there would be no payment of fees?
There would be no. I suppose that would probably be up to the parties, sir.
I mean, voluntary, obviously, but I mean the mandatory ones.
It is my experience, it would be my observation, that where negotiations have gone on for very, very long periods of time, it was because the parties were willing to let them go on.
Sure. Representative Kelly.
Service fee payers are non-union members.
They are not members.
However, they are paying for the service.
Yes.
And so during this period of time, whatever period of time that might be, they're paying nothing to the union. Am I right? If under the worst case scenario, they're paying nothing. Correct?
They are not compelled to.
Okay. And I guess that includes the portions of their payment that go for collective bargaining, yes. From what Representative Davis asked you, that includes the portion that goes to Representative Davis.
Well, their fee should, at least theoretically, is only those things that go to collective bargaining.
So they continue to benefit from the last contract, in terms of the last contract, because that would, ostensibly, that would be in effect, wouldn't it, at that period?
Some of it would be in effect. Often all of it is. But some of it has to remain in effect until impasse.
Practically speaking, they're under the terms of the last contract then.
For the terms that really matter to an individual employee, their wages and hours and such like, that's true.
I'm just trying to follow the mentality here, because they're paying for a service that they're getting here, it seems to me. Under this Section 23, they would not be required to pay for a service that they would in fact be getting.
Right.
The logic behind this is that the only thing which you can authorize union security with is a collective bargaining agreement. And when the agreement expires, then there is no device by which you authorize union security.
Except there is benefit accruing to the service payer.